Breakout sessions at the end of the day. We have Bridging the Urban-Rural Divide with Professor Catherine Kramer, Sarah Lloyd, and Mike McCabe back at Tent One, How to Rebuild the Broken Urban-Rural Political Alliance.
For those who are just arriving, this is the breakout session on Bridging the Rural-Urban Divide. We're going to get started. And there are going to be people continuing to join us, so hopefully we'll fill the tent by the time we get too far along. But thanks for coming to this session. My name is Mike McCabe. I'm the founder and president of Blue Jean Nation and used to run the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign for many years. I'm joined by Sarah Lloyd, who I've known for many years because of her work at Wisconsin Farmers Union. She also happens to be a candidate for Congress in the 6th Congressional District against Glenn Grothman. And then also Kathy Kramer, who is with the University of Wisconsin's Mortgage Center and is the author of the book, The Politics of Resentment. And I wanna plug that book. If you haven't yet picked up The Politics of Resentment and you are interested in solving the rural riddle or better understanding the way people are thinking and feeling in rural Wisconsin, and it certainly you can extend those lessons really across the country, I really highly recommend Kathy's book. It is well worth picking up. You will gain great insight. I've asked each of the panelists to make very brief sort of stage-setting remarks to kickstart the discussion, but for the most part, our time together is just going to be interactive. So be ready with your questions, and we'll turn this into a discussion. I'll start and just let you know that if you don't know of my background, I was raised on a dairy farm in Clark County, about halfway between Eau Claire and Wausau, and so this topic, this issue of bridging the urban-rural divide, is something that's very near and dear to my heart. And in my work now with Blue Jean Nation, I'm traveling almost exclusively outside of Madison, mostly to small towns and various rural places around the state. I've had meetups and sessions with people in barns, in feed mills, in local libraries, community centers, churches, every imaginable place where people would gather, I've met with people. And one of the things that I'm fascinated by, and really the only thing I will share with you before we launch into discussion and I turn it over to Kathy and Sarah, is that when I talk to rural audiences, when I go to rural places, what I find is that people have largely rejected progressives and progressive policies and progressive values. And when they hear the word Democrat or liberal or progressive, those words carry an enormous amount of baggage. Those words have very distinct meaning. And when I talk to urban audiences, they are often taken aback by what I describe when I talk about the meaning that those words have. When I grew up outside of a little town named Curtis, 150 people in Clark County. Curtis had the distinction in the last election of giving Scott Walker his biggest percentage margin of victory of any community in the state. Scott Walker won my hometown with 90% of the vote. That area is redder than Waukesha by a considerable margin. But when I was growing up, the area sent Democrats to the Capitol to represent the area. So I've watched this transformation, this realignment occur. And if you go to places like that, you go to Greenwood, you go to Abbotsford, you go to Owen or Neillsville, and you say words like Democrat or liberal or progressive, it has meaning to them. It means elitist, it means condescending, it means arrogant, it means people who think that we're stupid and are voting against our own interests, people who believe we're racists, people who believe that they know how to run our lives better than we know how to run our lives. There's an enormous amount of resentment about progressives and progressive policy in places like I grew up. Yet, as a child, racism was just as evident. I saw the Posse Comitatus literature regularly distributed, and those who don't know the Posse, it's the Northern KKK. Vile, racist, and anti-Semitic literature being distributed regularly. I saw it. They were just as fond of guns as they are now. They were just as into hunting. They were just as socially conservative. All of that was there when I was young, and yet they were sending Democrats to the Capitol to represent them. Today they are voting overwhelmingly Republican. Something has happened. I think it behooves people with progressive values to begin to understand better their sense of place, their worldview, their way of life, their language. And yet when I talk to urban audiences, they are at a loss for why these people in rural areas are thinking the way they're thinking. Then when I talk to urban audiences, I regularly hear, but these people are voting against their own interests. These people are only voting the way they're voting because they're racists. And I say, wait a second. Have you looked at the 2008 election results? If they're all racists, why did so many of them vote for Barack Obama? They voted for Republicans for every other office. Yet an awful lot of people, large percentages of people, voted to elect the first black president. Why'd they do that if they're all racists? There's a riddle here that has to be deciphered, and who better to help decipher that riddle than a working family farmer like Sarah Lloyd, who sits on the National Dairy Board. She's been a leader with Wisconsin Farmers Union for a long, long time. She lives and breathes this stuff in rural Wisconsin. And then Kathy Kramer, who went off to an awful lot of coffee shops and cafes and listened to people in rural areas, which is not a behavior befitting your typical university professor. But it made me have respect and admiration for Kathy that really is off the charts, because I love the fact that a university professor decided that something could be learned by just going out and listening to people in small towns, rural communities, and hearing what's on their minds. And so which one of you would like to share some thoughts first? Sarah.
Thanks. So my name is Sarah Lloyd, and my husband and I dairy farm with his family up near the Dells in Columbia County. And for folks who've heard me speak before, I lovingly joke that I married the last Norwegian bachelor farmer of the town of Newport. His name is Nels Nelson. That's his name, and Joanne's nephew. And we milk 400 cows with his family, or my husband, his brother, and my in-laws. And I work off the farm for the Wisconsin Farmers Union and the Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative. And so I am eating, living, breathing this rural existence, and am also trying to understand how I'm coming at things, how my neighbors are coming at things. And I also will offer the unique perspective is that I have been running for Congress since March in the 6th Congressional District, which covers 11 counties, very rural areas and urban also. The 6th Congressional District goes from the Wisconsin Dells to the Wisconsin River all the way over to Sheboygan and Manitowoc. Has Washera County, Marquette County, Green Lake County, Ozaukee County, Fond du Lac County. I have put 20,000 miles on my car, and I'll probably put another 20 between now and the election. So I've really been out and talking with people, but my work on the Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative and the Wisconsin Farmers Union has been about building better markets, building better economic markets for farmers for their products. We know that agriculture is a strong economic force. It remains to be a strong economic force in the rural areas, but sadly, like a lot of other industries, what we've seen is concentration and consolidation in that industry. So we have fewer farmers, but we have more production. We have failing rural communities or loss of vibrancy in the rural communities. If you drive up and down the main streets, you see a lack of vibrancy. Yet we have record levels of money flowing through the agribusiness systems. And to me, this is a critical, the political economic kind of structure of that loss is to me an opportunity. If we can all work together to provide economic opportunity, but make sure that as we're building the economic opportunity, we're paying attention to the social relationships. So, full disclosure, I'm a rural sociologist, so I will give you a little rural sociology here that is important to me, and I see it, the theory is that the economy used to be embedded in social life, and that production of economic goods, and in this case agricultural goods, if we're looking at the farm economy, was really, there was a social order and a social relationship that was strengthened through that production. But as we've moved away from the sort of mechanical interaction of creating those economic goods, we've lost the social power of agriculture. And the great transformation was indeed when the social life became subsumed by the economic. So it used to be that social life drove the economic interactions. The transformation came when it flipped and the economy dominated and we lost the social interactions. But guess what? Wisconsin's at the forefront of reimagining that. So look at the success of our farmers markets. Look at the success of the CSA movement, where people are getting the weekly box of vegetables. I have dear, dear friends that you may have come in contact personally, or you may have seen them on Wisconsin Foodie or in different magazines. Kat Becker and Tony Schultz are up in Athens, outside of Athens, Wisconsin. Tony Schultz, dairy farm kid, they lost their farm in the early 90s because of just the rigor of trying to run a small business, a dairy farm business. Tony married a woman from New York City, Kat Becker, and they dreamed of farming together. And they moved back up to the family farm. They have a 175 per family CSA, so they're producing at least 175, they may be up to 200 now, separate boxes of vegetables a week. They've put in pizza ovens, outdoor pizza ovens. They grow the wheat and grind it for the crust. They raise the pigs for the sausage for the pizza. They do all the canning of the tomatoes. And they get hundreds and hundreds of people. They do Friday night pizzas when it's okay to sit outside. And they get hundreds and hundreds of people out to their farm. Now, granted, they get the Wausau people, and they're starting to get the Marshfield people. But they're getting a lot of their neighbors. They're allowing interns on their farms, kind of apprentice style. And then they're convincing these young families to buy the farm next door so they can have some neighbors. They're entering floats in the local Athens parade and dressing up like vegetables and running down the streets of Athens. And they're local. I mean, Tony Schultz is from there through and through, multiple generations. What I'm saying is I actually think that in Wisconsin we have a really unique opportunity with food. Because if you saw me speak this morning, raise your hand if you ate something in the last 24 hours. So, you know, we have a unique opportunity, but very important, Mike points out a really important thing. When the Madison foodies start coming to town and shaking their fingers about what sort of production practices they want to see on people's farms, that's not going to be a good starter. I don't suggest that we start the conversation there. And within that conversation, we also have an opportunity with clean water. because clean water is essential and people are feeling it at home in their rural communities right now because of what's going on in agricultural production. But again, having a Madison or Milwaukee or DeForest progressive person that wants farmers to succeed, that wants to have good food, that wants rural communities to succeed, come and start lecturing people about their production practices, I don't recommend it as a starting place. I recommend listening. Listening. You know, what would a 400 cow multi-generational farm that has $1 million in debt to the bank in cement and stainless steel and doing the things that the university told us to do to get maximum production, what would we need to transition our farm into some different production practices that perhaps urban and suburban eaters might feel more comfortable with? And importantly, what do we need? We have to be able to make a living doing that. And that's not just up to the eaters to do. I talked this morning about heavy, heavy concentration in the agribusiness industry and monopoly power. So we do need intervention into monopoly power as a market force. But we also need to work together to understand where each other are coming from. And I would really encourage you that if you're concerned about production practices on certain farms, that perhaps lead with an open question of, well, what if you could farm in a different way, or if you're thinking about trying to get your next generation in, what would you need? And then let's get people on a 5 to 10 year plan of transitioning so that they can bring the next generation in, so they can think about what they would really actually need to make. And I actually feel like this is a real opportunity, because we're creating, you know, as much as we're creating this sort of people are voting against their best interests, we're also creating this kind of, oh, those farmers are terrible because they're producing food in this way. But I'm stuck as a 400 cow dairy farmer. I'm on the treadmill of production and I'm running as fast as I can just to keep my business's head above water. And so I need kind of a group transition plan. And so I'm not apologizing for, you know, I don't want to be an apologist for it, but Wisconsin still has lots of farms. I sit on the National Dairy Board. We still have 9,000 dairy farms. Sadly, there were 14,000 in 2007 when the census was last taken. But I talk to people in Tennessee. They have like 128 dairy farms in the whole state of Tennessee. So they don't know why I'm crying because we're losing farms. But so we still have distributed, diversified production in this state. But we're going to lose it if we don't act together and act fast. But I would ask for the taking the opportunity of food and water, but entering with a listening ear first and asking people for what they would need to be able to keep their businesses running, because clearly we need farmers on the land if we want to get the things that we need, and we need agribusiness to not have monopoly power and not have monopoly power in our democracy either. So that's sort of my charge and my lecture. Sorry.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you. Hi, everybody. And thank you, Mike, for inviting me to do this, and it's an honor to be here with the two of you. How many of you have lived part of your lives in a rural community or small community? Yeah, okay. So a lot of what I'm going to say, you're going to think to yourself, well, no kidding, lady. but the thing, much of what I'm going to say resonates with what Mike said. And I think it's important because a lot of us city folks, it's all new, right? This is a surprise. So as Mike said, I study public opinion, and I started a project on using people in Wisconsin. That's a terrible way to put it. But using time in communities across Wisconsin as a way to get at a question that's kind of irrelevant,
What I did was to listen to people in gas stations and diners and such, and what I heard really surprised me. I'm a lifelong Wisconsinite, and I called myself a small-town Wisconsinite until about 10 years ago, when people in so-called outstate Wisconsin quickly corrected me and said, you know, Grafton, Wisconsin, between Milwaukee and Sheboygan, is not small-town Wisconsin, honey. You know, when I was growing up, there was about 7,000 people there. But here's, I think, the nugget of what's important for us all, what I heard. I was struck about a year into my field work. It was hard to ignore the fact that what I was hearing in the smaller communities around the state was a whole lot of resentment toward the cities. And it was this sense of, you know, people in rural Wisconsin just do not get their fair share. We don't get our fair share of political power. We don't have any say in decisions that govern our lives, and they're made by people in the cities down in Madison or Milwaukee, and they're communicated out and just assuming that we're going to abide by them and that they'll fit whatever our life or our communities are like. So we don't get our fair share of power. We don't get our fair share of resources. There's this sense that Madison sucks in all of our money, spends it on itself or on Milwaukee, and we don't see it in return. And then there's also this sense that we don't get our fair share of respect. Like Mike said, you know, city people think we're a bunch of racist idiots, or city people who are making the decisions don't understand what small town life is like, or what our concerns are, or what we care about, or our values. And that was all politically very important over the subsequent years that I was out and about in the state, because basically what people were telling me was, you know, whatever government is doing, it's not working for us. You can look around our community, Kathy, and you can just see that things are falling apart. And we're sick and tired of working really hard, and our perception is that our money is going to places and to people who don't have respect for us, don't care about us, aren't listening to us, and don't understand what our concerns are. So, you know, when Act 10 rolled around and Scott Walker said, public employees, we need to cut back on their benefits, make them pay more into their health care insurance, their pensions, and basically outlaw public unions, a lot of the people I was spending time with were really supportive of that. They were basically saying to me, well, it's about time. It's about time, because here I am breaking my back, working really hard to make ends meet, and I can't afford to pay for health insurance. And you're telling me I'm supposed to pay for health insurance for those public workers who don't work very hard and are basically doing their jobs according to city-based rules that don't have any kind of, you know, understanding of what the life is like of people out here in small-town communities. So this resentment has become just politically really important. It's just laid very fertile ground for arguments to roll back government, cut back on public unions, cut back on public employees. So I'll leave it at that, unless there's anything else you want me to say at this point. But we're all eager to have a conversation, I think. So
your turn. What do you... Yes. Questions. What would you like to talk more about? What comments do you have? Jump in.
Kathy, I heard you speak on this before, and I don't know if you missed. It was a while ago. So I'm hoping maybe in the course of your academic work, you had some inspiration or insight. What can we do to fix it?
Well, I wish I knew precisely what would fix it, but I do believe in listening profoundly, like all three of us do, and that sounds like a pie in the sky kind of solution, but I think it's essential, and I mean that it's essential in order to both figure out what kind of policies would actually help people in rural communities, and also to convey respect. So a whole lot of listening has to go on before people in many of these communities agree to try a solution that anybody from a city comes up with, right? But as time has gone on, I'm increasingly struck by the need for fast internet, broadband, in rural communities, as I think Russ Feingold was talking about, because it's about jobs. I mean, small business owners, kids in school, people wanting to get more education, it's just kind of essential, it seems. So I would offer up those two things.
If I could amplify a theme that Kathy's hit on a little bit, when I go out and talk to urban audiences, one of the things I often, I'll raise some of the same points that have been already raised, and one of the things that I get back from people is, well, don't they appreciate all the farm subsidies that they get? And, you know, they're bellyaching about the welfare and everything, and they see the money going to Milwaukee. And one of the things that they'll say about Democrats, for example, is that that's the party of handouts. That's the party that takes from people who work and gives to people who don't. But then the pushback is that, well, don't they appreciate all the farm subsidies? And one of the points I make is that you have to keep in mind that most people who live in rural areas don't live on farms. They live in small towns, and they don't see those farm subsidies. So I would first echo what Kathy said about the internet. Just talked to another dairy farmer yesterday who said, Mike, we don't have internet access. And it's really hard to run a farm business because we're supposed to file payroll taxes online. We're supposed to check markets and see prices. We want to see that online. And we can't get internet access. That's a big deal. And so one of the things I often point out to urban audiences is that if you go down the gravel road that leads past our old farm, you will see electric wire going to every barn and every farmhouse all the way down this dirt road. And in fact, you'll find it down every dirt road. And that was a national effort. Rural electrification dramatically changed life in rural America. But if you drive down that gravel road, you can't get a mobile phone signal, and you can't get an internet connection. So if the Democrats wanted to make a better offer than has been made to them by the Republicans, one place to start would be to say, let's take mobile phone service and high-speed internet to every doorstep. And then yesterday, I was in Toma and then Waupun, and I twice had people come up to me and said, you know, I've just been at a town board meeting where they are discussing turning paved roads back into gravel. I'm not kidding. They're talking about reconverting paved roads to gravel because they can't afford to maintain the pavement. And so we're building all these clover leafs, we're building all the traffic circles, we're pouring all this money into new highway construction. What if the Democrats said, let's shift a chunk of our transportation budget to local road aid, and let's say to local communities, use this to take care of the pavement. That would be a huge deal. And then finally, again, I heard from people again, yes, just yesterday, about a local school in their town closing, which means busing their kids maybe 2 hours to go to school. What if an offer was made that we're going to have a rural school rescue plan that makes sure that no local community school closes? That's the kind of thing that would send a signal to local folks who don't believe they're being treated fairly or that they're even being heard. That would say to them, we get it. We understand what's gone haywire, and we're going to make an investment here. But I'm astonished when I say these things to urban audiences. It's like they've heard it for the very first time. What do you mean they are turning paved roads to gravel? That's happening in a lot of places around the state of Wisconsin. What do you mean the kids ride the bus for 2 hours? That's happening in a lot of places in Wisconsin. What do you mean they can't get a mobile phone signal or an internet connection? That's everywhere around the state of Wisconsin. Those are the kinds of things where I think there needs to be greater urban awareness of those rural challenges if we're going to build bridges and recreate urban and rural alliances. Anything to add?
Yeah.
I want to take that one step farther. I just moved here to Madison from Baraboo,
your area, not your district, unfortunately, where I live and work amongst the Ho-Chunk people. And one of the biggest problems is not just roads, but transportation. If somebody has lost their driver's license from drinking, or is too young, how do they get to a job if there's no transportation? Or the grocery store, you know, people are unable to do anything without transportation. And there is no public transportation in any of the rural areas that I've been in Wisconsin. None. So how do people better their lives? How do kids get to the library, for crying out loud? If the library is in Baraboo and they live out in Lake Delton, they can't do it. They can't do it. And this is definitely impacting not just the economy of people in rural areas, but particularly Native people. Not everybody can or wants to work at the casino. Not everybody, and the casino pays for shit anyway. I'm sorry, it's the truth. Not everybody gets a per cap, you know, and those who do get the per cap, unfortunately, if they don't have other jobs, the per cap puts them just above the poverty level, so they can't get medical assistance, they can't get food stamps, they can't get any other kind of assistance. People are trapped in poverty, especially in the Native lands. Now, our Native people are standing up for water. Our Native people stopped the Pinocchio iron mine. That was the Ojibwa standing on that land saying, this is ours. These are also people y'all need to be listening to, talking to, and hearing. Ho-Chunk people were farmers before they were removed from their lands. They would be happy to work with you. Ojibwa would be happy to work with you because they're trying to keep the rice lands, you know, clear water. So, you know, listen to us too.
Thank you. It's interesting to hear about all the urban problems or the rural problems, and those are valid concerns, but we could probably go on for a long time too about the very valid urban problems either. But I think those are valid things. I would like Sarah to talk a little bit more about water and what she meant by that. I know she hit a little bit on local food and some of the things that are going on in the food side, but I wanted to hear a little bit more about water.
So people are paying attention to water. I'm really been pleasantly surprised or unpleasantly surprised that we have such a threat to clean water, and also water quantity is becoming an issue in Wisconsin, which of course people are like, how could that be? We're supposed to be this great state of water. And a lot of times to me, the solutions that people immediately come up with for dealing with the water issue is looking to government for some sort of regulatory response to the clean water issue. And we need that when people in Kewaunee County are turning on their taps and cow shit is coming, you know, because they're in the karst landscape and their actual groundwater is contaminated with manure. And we need to make sure that we can work on the regulatory side. Obviously, the state has completely abdicated its duty in protecting water. I would actually connect it to the food is that if we continue in a food system that's dominated by large-scale agribusiness and is pushing people to either get big or get out, we're basically pushing a structure that's creating risk for clean water. And again, by sort of looking at small and medium-sized producers, I consider a 400-cow dairy a medium-sized producer in Wisconsin. I feel like we're gigantic. But when I go to a 12,000-cow dairy, which we have multiple 12,000-cow dairies now in Wisconsin, we're a little ant. And if we don't want this risk, because it's not, to me, it's not an acceptable risk to concentrate all these animals into one place. It's You remember when they had the stadium deal in Milwaukee and Walker stood up there and had that little sign in the podium that was like, cheaper to keep them? Remember that was like the line about the tax money from the payroll of the players? I think it was like, cheaper to keep them. Whenever anybody asks me about, well, you just have to let people get bigger farming because that's the only thing to do, I want that podium thing to say, not worth the risk. Like, you can't give me any argument to say why we should have more 12,000 cow dairies, because it's not worth the risk to the water. And but we can't just rely on government regulation, because clearly we're not creating the political will at the state or federal level right now to get that going. But consumer pressure, we have seen a lot of movement in production practices with consumer pressure. So think about synthetic bovine growth hormone. There is not much synthetic bovine growth hormone used for fluid milk, like what you would pour on your cereal. And that's because consumers said, no, we don't want it. And Walmart went, oh, shoot, our consumers say they don't want it. And they pushed the entire industry to switch away from that production practice. Look at what's happening with GMOs. I mean, the agribusiness is freaking out because the consumer pressure on GMO labeling has been really effective, and the suppliers and processors are scrambling. What if people said, not worth the risk, I don't want large-scale concentrated production for my food, and pushing the supply chain to respond to that with consumer pressure? That we would probably get quicker movement on reducing concentrated risk to water than if we try to get the Walker's DNR to do something. So I think that, I mean, as far as our opportunities, now that's going away from what the rural-urban divide is, but the urban eaters are the ones that can create the consumer pressure. But again, let's bring farmers in collaboration on that, because I don't want to get bigger than 400 cows. I'd rather be able to make a living with 150 cows, because that would be a reasonable amount of work for three families together. But I can't make a living. I can't make a living with 400 cows right now. So, yeah. But we.
And we used to be able to scrape by with 40.
Yeah.
I saw some hands over here. Who had one up first? Go ahead.
I just wanted to touch on the idea with Sarah about smaller cooperative dairies, and trying to push stores to carry products from smaller producers. My background in that comes from my uncle drove for Golden Guernsey back in the day, and he would go out to five or six farms and then collect the milk and take it to the dairy. Well, they had kind of a cooperative thing going there. And for a while, Golden Guernsey was carried down here in Madison, but I haven't seen it since I came back to the state. We ought to be pushing that.
Well, actually, the reality is that 75% of all milk in the United States is moved through farmer-owned cooperatives. So it's not that the cooperatives don't exist, but the question is, Golden Guernsey and Morning Glory actually were Foremost Farms brands that we gave away to Dean. So it's this complicated story. But there are, so the Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative is a cooperative that I work on, which started with 11 farmers to aggregate fresh vegetables to sell into the retail grocery wholesale market. We have 37 farmers now. We'll have over $2.5 million in sales this year. So that's the kind of thing that we need to encourage, because you can have your farmers market, you can have your CSA, but then how are you going to scale that up? Because not everyone can take everything to the farmers market. You know, we sort of need to have a distributed system. And the USDA, big props to the Obama administration for getting money into the USDA to actually fund farmer-owned cooperatives. So there's a lot of cool projects going on that are getting support from the federal government. Now, you know, how do we tell that story so that, you know, farmers feel like, wow, someone's paying attention to my needs, like someone's trying to help me make this happen. I think that there's promise there, because a cooperative economy, the other thing that we see is if I have a cooperative economy, it's not going to offshore itself to some other country or like consolidate for better shareholder return, because that's not in the cooperative economic business structure. So it creates, to me, a more resilient economy that perhaps holds on longer in the rural areas or the urban areas, because it's a different business model. So I mean, I think there's promise there too.
How about we go there and then we'll go back there?
Two things real quick. One of which is, there is an ad I heard on the radio, which I was glad to hear. It's from some Democratic thing for the road builders, and they're talking about the poor roads and vote the GOP out, which I think is good, because they're essentially putting the problem where it belongs. They're labeling it. They're addressing those issues. That's one thing. And the other thing with the politics of resentment, and I think it was Tony Schultz who was actually up at the Capitol during the protests, and he was talking about the Athens school being affected by it, and that the voucher money is going to Waukesha County, where plenty of people can afford there, are just now getting a tax break. So I think what you do is you turn the politics of resentment on its head, and you put it where the money is going. It's going upstream, it's going to the wealthy, and you make that very clear. I mean, the problem, when I hear Democrats talk, they go, oh, the problem is Congress. No, the problem isn't Congress, the problem is the Republicans in Congress. You know, it's the people who don't know who their even senators are, or their congressmen are. They need to know. You need to label who they are. You need to tell the story. And I'm not saying you don't, but we need to tell the story. Where did the money go? What was it like? How does it get better? Anyway, I'll...
Thank you. Well, you know, he said it better than I could. Thank you for making the point. I mean, and really, you know, it is an important thing for, and as Sarah was just saying, to talk about what government does for us and who in government is doing what, just to make that more plain. And a lot of times we kind of skip over that, you know. So
well, if I don't leave right after this, I will be walking back to Milwaukee. So but I just I just would like to have you think about the zoning and the problems of water. We would have water taken if Garvey had not defended us and been our lawyer. Our water would have been sold as Ice Mountain because Nestle's had a permit to take 500 gallons per minute with no environmental impact statement about 15 years ago. Garvey was our lawyer. We beat them, but zoning is important. Newport, where Sarah lives, is zoned agriculture. You go on the other side of Wisconsin Dells, and it's honky-tonk all the way to Baraboo. That's because there's no zoning. We were warning Waukesha for years, zone, stop sprawling, you're going to have a water problem. They knew that before. The Pabst Farm should not have been cemented over so that nature could take its course. Rural schools, little schools for young children, they ought to be in the rural areas. If you're going to bus them so they can know what nature is about. Let the big kids go to the high schools. But too many people, and the farmers resent the city people moving out to the country, the beautiful country, but they want to take everything from the city out, and they're sore about the smells, and they're sore about not having all of the advantages of the city. Well, then they ought to stay in the city. This is one of our biggest problems. And now I better leave or I'll be walking.
And no more honky-tonk zoning.
I want to reinforce some of the comments made earlier. Having knocked on a lot of doors over a lot of years, more than any single issue, people want to feel listened to. It's interesting also in terms of perspective. In 2006, Herb Kohl carried every single county in Wisconsin except Washington County. He carried Iowa County by a larger percentage than Dane County. And I serve on a local school board, and to me, I think one of the critical issues that's affecting particular rural communities right now is cutbacks in education. Schools are the critical to the survival and success of rural communities, and increasingly, they're experiencing declining enrollment, rising costs, falling property values, increasing taxes. It's a difficult situation when you're trying to attract a family or trying to attract employers when rural school districts are going under. It's a death spiral. And I think the real critical thing that we need to focus on is providing more resources for schools as a center for the revitalization of our rural communities as a way of attracting both families and businesses, and along with high-speed internet, I think a critical factor for revitalizing much of rural Wisconsin. One of the things that I found, which is absolutely abhorrent, with the whole school voucher system, there are communities in Wisconsin where the public schools are getting $7,000 less per student than a private voucher school student, even if they're living in the same community. That money comes off the top. It's an outrage.
My name is Diane, and I've got a really good idea for bridging the gap between Republican, Democrat, rural, and city. Melissa Sargent set up a bill called the Lime Bill, and there was a huge testimony for this Lime Bill. We did this in about February, and a huge number of people came forward, and I spoke to Frank Lassie and a lot of Republicans, and I could not believe that we would be so together, because I'm a solidarity singer. I know what's going on at the Capitol. And the thing about Lyme in this country, a lot of doctors, a lot of polls say that Wisconsin is the second most endemic in the country, and that Maine is the first. Whether it's first or second or third, it's really very prevalent. And there is a prohibition on Lyme treatment in this state. Many doctors who treated people with chronic Lyme, they lost their license. They got sued. So any way to get treatment for Lyme in this country, it's like an underground. And I've had it since 89. I didn't know until 2014, because I went through every different kind of doctor and treatment. And since I've been treated in 2014, I got my shoulder back. I mean, I'm on the right track now, but it's very much hush-hush. And people are really suffering. And right now there's a bill going through. We're pushing it through the Senate. If you want to call, I just talked to Tammy Baldwin about it. We're pushing it right now. So if you call Tammy, and I don't know if Ron will listen to you, but also Mark or any of your other representatives, like people who get bit by ticks have the right to have treatment. And the doctors should have the right to treat it as they know fit. One of the things that the university doctors, they're not very supportive of us. There is a Lyme test that the mainstream medicine does that they automatically give you. It's a $40 test called the ELISA. It tests for two strains, and the patent on this ELISA test are the same doctors that sit on the infectious disease board. That test is a garbage test, and a lot of people get misdiagnosed. The two big tests that are really good are Igenix, which tests for 100 strains, or the iSpot that's in Osseo, Wisconsin. That's the best, most sensitive test that's coming out right now. So people are risking their lives as professionals to treat patients. And there's not a farmer that will argue with me. I'm from Crawford County. So if we really help Melissa Sargent and a Republican guy, his first name is Corey, I forgot his last name, push the thing through here in Wisconsin, it's probably going to come up in the fall or winter. Walker's not going to do a thing about it, but it would just be awareness. And right now, we need to go federal. We need to go Tammy and Russ Feingold, and that will be a huge bridge. Thank you.
I heard especially two things from you from the panel tonight, which was one, the divide between rural and citizens and not feeling heard. I'm wondering what would make you feel heard or what would work, what works and what doesn't work. I'm an advocate of the power of the pen and wanted to know what could help.
Okay. Sarah, do you want to speak to that? You want me to speak?
Well, my early background was a lot like Mike McCabe's, although in my profession I became a county agent and then an ag economist with the University of Wisconsin, recently retired. And so I've had a long career of dealing with farmers, farm families, rural folks. And farmers and rural folks tend to like things that are practical, things that they can use to help them, you know, today, tomorrow, not 10 years from now, for one thing. You know, they're interested in the weather because that affects what they do. I mean, for a farmer, you know, if you want to get a farmer to commit to something 2 weeks from now, you won't, because he doesn't know what the weather is going to be. And that really has a big impact on what he does every day, et cetera, et cetera. And working as a county agent, of course, I was always very careful to try and when people ask me questions, I really tried to very hard to understand what the question is that they're asking me before I started answering. And usually that meant asking them a few additional questions as they talked to me to make sure that I understood really what they were asking before I assumed that I knew what they were asking. And, you know, using that technique, I usually was able to figure out what really are they asking me to know. And I know just myself in conversations that I have with most people are very quick. They jump to the, you know, it's not unusual for people to interrupt other people midway through their first sentence and assume they know what that person wants to talk about, and generally they don't. They misdiagnose. So farmers typically are introverts, but if you talk to them about the weather, you talk to them about their farming operation, you'd be surprised how talkative they can be, especially if, of course, I had an advantage with my professional background that I did understand a lot about farming, etc. So we could carry on a conversation in which they knew they were talking to somebody that understood their business and the issues that they had. Now, if you don't have that background, it's harder to do that. Let me just add one more thing. Affordable health care has been a major problem for farmers for the last 30 years. 30 years ago, I did a seminar as a county agent to talk about the problem of getting affordable health care, you know, in rural areas. And we're still struggling with that. That's still a major problem. That's one of the reasons that on many farm families, somebody in the family has a non-farm job primarily so they can qualify for some affordable health insurance program package. And even then, just a few years ago, I talked to a farm family where the wife worked for a hospital, had health insurance through that job, but that health insurance had a clause in it that excluded coverage for people doing farm work. The husband got injured on the farm, was not covered. Just a tragic story.
That is a really incredibly important point, and I can speak to that personally. My family did not have health insurance, and I once took a pitchfork through the hand. A pitchfork went through my hand, and my parents couldn't take me to the doctor. They wrapped a poultice of Epsom salts around my hand, and risked the infection because we had no health insurance. And then I had a bad encounter with a barbed wire fence and ripped my leg open from sort of high calf to lower thigh. And again, a poultice of Epsom salts was wrapped around the wound. It wasn't stitched, nor was I taken to the doctor. And so I have a really ugly series of scars because they were never the wound was never stitched. And it was because we didn't have health insurance. So, and you have a hard time getting it because you're in a high-risk occupation. That's an incredibly important point. And I know you wanted to add something on the point of...
I wanted to go back to the question about how do you convey that you're listening? It's a great question. And I think you had a great answer there. Asking questions is one part. Yeah. And I think another is coming back time and time again, right? Not just holding one town hall meeting, but actually it's both the kind of going to where people are in the course of their daily life and not expecting them to come to some kind of format that's not a part of their everyday life, and returning again and again, right? So that I think you convey, yes, I really care what you think by coming back again.
You know, there's also, this is going to sound silly in a way, but I was at a rural forum some time ago, and it was a panel discussion, and one of the panelists was very opinionated about what this particular rural community should consider for strategies going forward that would help rehabilitate the community. But during the course of the discussion, and I don't even remember exactly how this came up, but it became clear that this participant in the discussion didn't know that a steer was a castrated bull. And that was a credibility destroyer. You could watch, you could see an entire audience refuse to listen to anything this man said the entire rest of the time that we spent there. And so learning how to speak the language of rural people and gaining some knowledge of their life is an incredibly important part of this too. And I don't know how you do that except spend some time in rural communities and listen to people talk about rural life. Yeah, go come on up.
Yeah, I want to share briefly what I did. I was at the University of Wisconsin getting my doctorate and raising a small family with my husband. And I decided I wasn't happy doing that. And we lived in rural Deerfield, and it was surrounded by farms. And as my children got older, I was mesmerized by the farming. And so I did something that did really work for me personally. I went to a local farmer and I said, "Hi, do you need help?" The guy looked at me and said, "You're too small, you know." But he taught me how to milk cows and taught me how to run a tractor. I later worked for a bigger farm with 200 head. And the farmers that I worked with for 10 years, it was a business operation. They're highly successful people. And count every penny, but they're very successful. When I first worked for them, they didn't respect me. I was a do-good Madison liberal, even though I wasn't from Madison originally. But as they saw me work, and as I saw them work, we got common ground, and we came to respect one another. And I never changed my politics. And we didn't talk about it much, but over time we started to talk about it. And they listened to me because they respected me. They knew that I had the same values that they did. I cared for the same things they did. I worked just as hard as they did for just as little money as they did. And I didn't do it in a patronizing way to fix them. They gave me a wonderful life. But I did more than just listen to them. I became a part of their life. And they became a part of my life. And I think, one of them is voting for Clinton. And I don't think it's because of me directly, but I broke down their misconception of what a liberal Madison Liberal was. You know.
That's a wonderful story.
But not everybody can do that. Not everybody would want to do that. But we did find common ground, and that was very important.
And then you can be an ambassador back to other people that you...
Oh, yes,
about
yes.
your experience.
Well, yeah, once I had to confess, I left a Fighting Bob Fest when someone was giving a talk where they were mocking rednecks, and I just thought, oh, no, you can't do that. Because, you know, you can't do that. You've got to understand
right.
where they're coming from.
Right.
Listen, and...
I grew up with a very redneck, by the way. One last comment or question, and then we're going to have to let y'all go home. Yeah. They're obviously signaling us that we need to leave.
Good. I was just curious, this has come up in some of the other questions, but not directly. If you could speak to the extent the movement of people is making this worse, or because I have this stereotype of small towns, young people move away, go to college, they don't come back, etc. Like, how big of a problem is that? Is that just a stereotype, or?
That's a wonderful point that you bring up, and I think you all can speak to it, but I was lobbied very intensely not to go to college. And living in, when I came to the University of Wisconsin, was living in Madison and got a lot of friends here, they thought, your parents didn't want you to go to college? But the fear is that you go to college and you'll never come back. And that's a very real fear. And so one of the suggestions I made, and I'm not saying it's a good suggestion, but I was once at a forum and I said, what if the university started having an approach of trying to create very small satellites out in small rural communities? And I was really kind of shouted down by a person from university administration who said, we're going in exactly the opposite direction. We're going more toward virtual learning online and all that. And I said, these people don't want, first they can't get internet. So how are they gonna get an online education? And they don't, you know, they don't want to send their kids far away because they're afraid they'll never return. That's a very real issue, a very big deal. We're gonna have to end it there because obviously they want our chairs. Thank you so much.